Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Welcome. This evening, we are going to be discussing a section of a publication that I featured last month, Advanced Flower Essence Healing with David Dalton. His book is so phenomenal and is so detailed on so many different aspects of dealing with the new frontiers in the field of Bach flower remedies that I wanted to go into more detail about this, because there is the science that goes along with the knowledge that he presents in the book, Advanced Flower Essence Healing. This is something that, as I was reading the material, I was very, very much aware of how we are changing, slowly but surely, the understanding about how alternative therapies are really making a difference. And this is something that it's information that I think enables us to be aware that there are ancient cultures that have had knowledge. There are so many different aspects that we are learning about having a better lifestyle, about being more aware of how we can improve ourselves physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. So this is information that I thought was very important to be able to share, because of the fact that we are seeing, becoming alert to, these different aspects that can bring the best of what we really feel our lives should empower us with. And I just think that my conversation with David in this program, and this is on the second half of his book, which is Researching Flower Essences. And David, I want to welcome you to the show again.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here again.
You know, you start off your second section, and for those that are listening to our conversation for the first time, I want people to know that you are a pioneer in the flower essence field, and you have worked as a practitioner of same, producer, researcher, and teacher since the 1980s, and you founded and are the principal of Delta Gardens in New Hampshire here in the United States. Now, this is a center for flower essence study and, again, research. And there is so much here that you have put into, I think, one of the most beautiful books I've ever seen, with the photographs that you have in there, but also the detail that you give. Now, you were in Uganda, and you had a man. You start off in the research keys in the first portion of this second segment of your book. This man, Leopold, was your driver, and when he wanted to know what you were doing, etc., which is normal conversation, you were telling him about flower essences. And in the African culture, at least to my awareness, there was a very, very strong association with flowers, different plants, trees, in their natural remedy environment. Why was it so perplexing to Leopold when you tried to explain this to him?
Well, I think Leopold had a very Western way of looking at things. The flower essence doesn't have a smell, and it doesn't have a taste, and there's no visual green stuff, let's say, in there. And so he saw that floating flower petals on the water and then pouring that liquid into, and he watched me do this, into a bottle. He just couldn't understand how I knew that there was something there worth coming all the way to Uganda to make, worth trying to save, worth trying to research. Leopold became a very, very helpful person to me. He would, once he understood, because how I explained to him what was in there, I had him try a few essences, and he had very visceral experiences with them, so much so that he went home and gave some of the essences to his wife. He would then help me when I would make an essence. If you've ever been to Africa, one of the difference, the big difference is an enormous number of people everywhere. And so when we were out in the wild and, you know, I started making an essence, all of a sudden there'd be like 30 people standing around wondering what we were doing. And Leopold would explain in Swahili to all the people, you know, what exactly was going on. He told me later that he was saying, this very famous doctor is making medicines. So anyway, that was a fun part of the journey. And Leopold was, he was kind of a symbol of the way people think about energy. You can't see it, but you can experience it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The cherry plum essence at the beginning of that chapter is something that you emphasize, because this actually was an experience that Dr. Bach had. And you mention a Bach biographer, Nora Weeks, and her book, The Medical Discoveries of Edward Bach, Physician. This, I don't think many people are aware that there was this publication. When did she publish her knowledge about him?
It was in the 1950s, I think. I think she wrote it shortly after he died, which was earlier in that century, you know, the 1930s. But she had been working with him for years and saw how brilliant he was. And not only that, she saw the results he was getting with his patients when he finally was able to assemble the essences and start treating people with them. So the book has been around for a long time, but like many books that are full of wisdom, it just fell aside.
Mm-hmm.
It's popular in England, where he worked and lived, and in parts of Europe. But anyone that does flower essences knows about Dr. Bach and his work.
Yes. Now, also in the chapter, you bring out George Washington Carver. Now, this man here in the United States, he was just incredible with his scientific discoveries and his brilliance. And you bring him out in the book, and the fact that he, like Dr. Bach, wasn't concerned about becoming famous or becoming wealthy. That wasn't his intention. But George Washington Carver was a man of a very deep spiritual faith, and he would take walks in nature and would observe. And I remember someone telling me years ago, if you want to know how to work with life, study nature. And I've never forgotten those words. And to find that expressed similarly in your book by Dr. Bach and George Washington Carver, who even today we can just find out about his background and we're in awe of what he did. He was just an extremely brilliant man, but very much associated with nature. And you also bring up some other people. And this has been almost like an evolution, perhaps we could say, David. You have Dorothy McLean, who is one of the founders of Finhorn Community. And even today, that is still a big topic of conversation, what these people did with an area of land that was just not worth anything. And then you talk about Peter Tompkins and Christopher Bird, and that was in the 70s, the 80s. Michelle Small Wright's book, Behaving as If God Is in All Life Mattered, 1990, you got a story from a student. So this is an evolution that has really taken a long time to even get recognition, isn't it?
Yes. One of the paradoxes here is that George Washington Carver, for instance, and Dr. Bach, they were both scientists. But there were scientists that had a gift, and that gift was they were able to establish some kind of rapport, communication, connection with plants where they were able to receive information, insights. And today, the world is so scientific that those experiences would be considered unscientific, and they'd be dismissed. And so both of them, during that time, had to do their best to keep quiet about their gifts and to more play forward their scientific discoveries, the value, the use, the recording of cases. And that's what gained them notoriety was scientists. It was doctors who were the first flower essence practitioners after Bach died. So scientists still do not recognize intuitive or mystical experiences as being valid. But that's changing. And I think, you know, one of the things that we have to think about is how do we put these two parts of ourselves together? Because in denying intuitive faculties, we're cutting off a part of ourselves. So the book, and especially the part that you're referring to today, the research part, is an attempt to make a bridge between science and intuition, between mm-hmm. deduction and inspiration, between real deep spiritual connection with plants and honoring the scientific process.
That is something that is very, very significant. And with quantum science, we are becoming closer to understanding that a lot of what we cannot see has energy, has life. And this again is an evolution of perception, and in part it has developed because of technology. But this is something that's been a part of the human perspective for literally millions of years. And there are right. those that will have those observation qualities. And actually, as it will be said by many people, that there is a communication with plants. And we have researchers that have brought out the information that the plants definitely respond to, you know, positive thought, negative thoughts. They will let you know if someone's not well. There's just all of this. It's a huge shift in this scientifically oriented process. But you are really, as a researcher yourself, you are wanting in this book for people to understand what they can do as far as keeping data and data collection. And this is very, very explicit, you know, the subject, the blind, you know, the blindness. And when you say the blindness, you mean that the person should not know what the essence is. You don't describe all of it to them. You just say, let's see it. So in a way, they are being part of a blind study. And
correct.
That is something that's very good. You have a time frame, a written questionnaire, instructions to how to work with people, the age and the gender of the person, the personality type, the structure for feedback is very, very well laid out. And then being able to do the not just the collection of the information, but also being able to look for similarities. You're looking for details and information, and that's what research is all about, isn't it?
Correct. Correct. So how we proceed is first through intuition, and we get some through observation and through our collection of understanding the general shape, the color, the type of flower it is, gives us a direction to think about first, and then we start giving the essence to people. The more we do that, the more we start seeing similarities. I remember having a group of 30 people and giving an essence, and, you know, generally 28 of the people had about the same kind of experience, you know, which was calming and relaxing and grounded. And so that gives us we can then kind of take that into a practice and try it out, put it in. Someone needs grounding, calming. Does this help? So over the years, we're talking like 35 years thousands of sessions, we begin to see clearly what an essence can do and how it does it. We can even predict, you know, based on the client's history and temperament, what's going to happen. And that makes the model that we're working with valuable.
Would artificial intelligence be able to assist in working with the data that you have? Because you think about the thousands of people that have already been researched, if you will, and then that ongoing process and data collection. Is there a data bank or some place where people can find out, you know, more about this? And you go into a lot of detail in your book. But I was wondering, would artificial intelligence help someone be able to do an assessment of their data collection if they were interested in exploring this more? Would that be a tool that could serve them well?
I think so. I when we interview people, there's a series of questions that we ask about their past, their medical history, their emotional past, trauma in the past, and then their physical conditions in the present, and those are usually the ones they're coming to see us about.
Mm-hmm.
And then what are the issues that you have in the present? So that kind of gives us a scaffolding to select the essences. So I suppose we could load that data someplace so that AI had. So I think artificial intelligence in any kind of process could be extremely helpful in guiding a person. But then, you know, the whole impulse moves into logic, because AI is very logical. And I think that this whole field was born, you know, through someone's intuition, and I wouldn't want to see that disappear from the field.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I think that's very important. I think any physician that has been, or anyone in science, as they have worked and they develop, they'll find that the intuition factor is extremely strong in a lot of their assessments. And it comes from experience. It comes from observation. And it's using all of your senses. So I think that that's very true. Now, you talk about the earth element, the water element, the fire element, earth, air, water. You know, all of this is very, very significant. And you go into detail with each segment. For example, with the earth element, you were talking about the qualities of a plant, shape, color, form, the growing conditions, which is very, very important. And you say it can tell us of its healing action and what imbalances might occur or could occur. This is really quite a complicated process. And you brought up something that all of us know about. It's the onion. And I was fascinated with just that one particular plant, the onion, all of the different components that it holds: earth, air, fire, and water. That was really something I was not expecting to see.
Nor I. The presence of the elements is easy to detect with some observation. So where is the air element? Well, the stalk of an onion is hollow. It's hollow. Where is the water element? Well, it produces tears, and it's juicy. Where is the earth element? It has a ball-shaped root that's very significant. And the fire element, you know, that burning quality of it. Mm-hmm. So it's an unusual plant. I mean, plants will show all of the elements, but what we look at is which ones are the most significant. What are the two strongest elements? And I think with onion, the fire and water elements give us an indication where to look in the system. What we use this for is releasing grief when people have developed inflammation, that's fire element, from blocking grief, which is the water element, usually in the lungs, there's the air element. Then this can be very helpful. There's a great example of a case where I used the onion flower essence for a woman that had pustular psoriasis on her hands. And one of the things I discovered in my assessment of her was that she had not expressed sadness through tears since she was a young person. Because when she did back then, you know, her face swelled all up and she decided she was never going to cry again. Anyway, through the onion essence and through getting her to feel comfortable expressing some grief, that psoriasis, the fire element, disappeared. Pustular psoriasis, it has water and fire in it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely mm-hmm. fascinating. There's also that emotional aspect, and that is really quite interesting because we are a total package, mind, body, spirit, and emotions. And I think of different doctors I've known through the years and how those that listened and were attentive to what was going on, they would really want people to talk. They would want you to express what you were feeling and what was happening, and it was dealing with the present, whatever that present was. And then you'd have other physicians that would not, and so many of them today don't even have but 15 minutes to see a patient. And it's really sad because it makes it difficult for the physician that really wants to get to know their patients so that they can work with that patient and help that patient achieve the balance that it needs. The researching of the water element. And now you say water has a less structure and solidity than earth, but more potential for movement, flexibility, and fluidity. And I was intrigued with the photography that you have in here because you have a hosta leaf that has lines on it, and it is about the water element. And you list in your book with each of these aspects, earth, air, fire, and water, you have a number of demonstrations, photographs, descriptions. Again, this is a publication that goes into so much detail that I've never heard anybody go into with the remedies, the Bach flower essences. It's quite interesting. This with the water, the hosta leaf, is quite beautiful. Is that a tropical plant?
Let's see, the hosta, you mean?
Yeah, the hosta. Yeah, H-O-S-T-A.
It's a very common garden plant. Hostas, they're really popular here in the Northeast. They're not one of my favorite plants, but I think because they're so ubiquitous. But you can see when you look at that plant, that those wavy lines mm-hmm. just give a feeling of water.
Yes, and then you all say go into flowers. You go into the petals, the information about them, six petals, the water signature. You talk about that, and you also mention in this segment on research the moon and how that is significant with certain plants. And there's a plant, it's just gorgeous, the flower, the datura. Why is the moon so significant?
Well, the moon has a relationship with water. The moon affects water on the earth. The moon moves the tides. Flower essences that are have a strong water signature, become more energetically vibrant during full moon cycles. The water and the six petals are significant. With the elements, we move up the chakras. Earth is the first chakra. Water is the second chakra. You look at the second chakra, pictures of it, you know, just go Google images of chakra two and you'll see six petals on that. Wonderfully enough, six petal flowers are all relate to the second chakra, which is the pelvic area, emotions, past trauma. And so, you know, essentially what we're doing in this book and what I'm doing in my work with flower essences is putting pieces together, pieces that are hidden in one sense, but when, you know, there's some observation and a presentation, of, it's easy to see. Remember, Leopold, when I started showing him photos of the flowers that I was working with, he asked me where they were, and I said, well, they're all over the place. This tree is right in the square, you know, in Kampala. He says he never sees them. He never sees them. And that's one of the things about the world today, going too fast to see the flowers. And so I'd like people to kind of look closely. If you look at the book, you'll see things that cue your mind to notice things about flowers and nature. Mm-hmm. Not just that they're pretty, but they're usefulness.
Very true.
Their language.
Very, very true. That's what I found so intriguing about your book, Advanced Flower Essence Healing, because this is something that in many different cultures around the world, they have studied those plants that are very much in their particular environment. In fact, they may not grow in another environment. And one of the aspects that often is recommended when you learn about Chinese medicine or Ayurvedic medicine or South Korean medicine or Native American medicines, they learned from the environments they lived in. And they would experiment. They would do their own kind of research. They didn't necessarily have the microscopes and the advanced technology like we have today. But sometimes it's those very subtle components that can make a huge, huge difference. And you go into the air and also the fire elements. And again, it was so intriguing to me. And then you also say you have to determine the dominant elements, you go into that. And then one of my favorite sections in this particular research area of the book, it was dealing with color. And color is so very, very important. When you were doing research and you were looking at all of these various components, how significant did you find color? Now, you mention it in your book. But when you're dealing with it, the tones of color can make a difference too, cannot not?
Yes, especially the tones of red and blue. There are two channels in the human energy system that connect all of the energy centers. And one of them is red, and it goes upward. And one is blue, and it goes downward. The red is all about stimulation and fight and flight and protection and, you know, anger and aggression. And so energy, that's vital energy that's expressed in the world, comes up through that red channel. The blue channel is quite the opposite. It's about calmness and relaxation and going offline and the adrenals shut off and one feels confident. Now, the red and blue is a big hue. You know, most of the tropical flowers that I've explored are red, orange, or yellow. And I've noticed that there are fewer blue flowers in nature than other colors. But those blue flowers are the ones that we use, you know, to help with calmness and grounding and, you know, helping people relearn how to relax, you know, if they've been too busy. The red or tinges of red we use to stimulate, to movement.
Mm-hmm.
Usually the kind of movement we're looking to stimulate is the movement of something that's stuck in the subconscious, the information that's causing pain, trauma. So all of those colors are important, significant. Yellow is, you know, the like the color of sunflower, color of confidence, you know, expression, power into the world. And so all of the colors have, so one of the questions we ask is, where is the blue and where is the red in this flower? And when we say red, we mean kind of red, orange, yellow. And when we say blue, we mean blue and green and even darker colors like brown. But you'll notice in the spring that all of the perennial plants, or most of them, they start off with a deep, deep red color, which is what we call the earth red, the color of chakra one. So it's just another key for us to use to explore. And when we say language of flowers, we don't mean flowers are saying hello to us, you know, in our language. We mean that they have their own language, and we can learn it, you know, first by observation, categorize, you know, separate experiences caused by the cult, and we then have a system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You call it color and signature. And lastly, I just want to touch on the peace rose. When I came to that section, the rose is a very, very significant flower. It's beloved by just about everyone. But when this rose was created, it was titled the Peace Rose for a reason. It was the desire to no longer have war. And it's a gorgeous, gorgeous rose, and it has an ever so slight tint of yellow in it. Your photograph of the flower is just beautiful. And you say this relates to the heart. It relates to the heart. This is something that is a very, very powerful essence. You say it clears the effects of the past and recognizes one's personality around higher realities. Your book is absolutely amazing. I know that the peace rose, along with many other rose species, have just had such a powerful effect on people overall, and it's dearly beloved. Your book, again, is just absolutely amazing to me, Advanced Flower Essence Healing, New Frontiers in the Field of Bach Flower Remedies. This is episode 2, and we're going to be talking again, and I so appreciate your giving me the time. We're going to be talking again about another section in your book, because this almost to me is like an encyclopedia. And part 3 is traditional flower essence practices addressing the personality. And that is a very significant section as well. Now, David Dalton, you do have your group, the Delta Gardens in New Hampshire, here in the United States. And this is also an opportunity for anybody that might be interested in exploring it, no matter what your culture is, what your background is. And they can go to your website, deltagardens.com. And do you offer classes?
Yes, I do. I have an online class of 15 recorded modules that people take, and then they get mentoring along the way. They have to do exercises, and they have to submit them, and then they have to do some cases afterwards. But we have, I might say, all of the book that you have there is kind of broken into sections in our training. Next year we'll have a live online class also that will kind of follow the sequence of the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, the sequence of the book is just incredible. And I think it really complements a lot of other areas of research that are being done at this time. And I find it so interesting that you were in Africa, you've gone to different places, and you've explored what other environments have produced. It really is a fascinating arena. And I look forward to our next conversation.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you. This has been such a pleasure.
I really appreciate your time, your effort, your research, and your energy in giving me the time.
Thank you.
We are saying goodbye to David Dalton, and I wanted to repeat his website, deltagardens.com, and we'll be doing episode number 3 in the next month series. So you'll be able to catch up with that, and we then will have an episode number 4 in the following month as well. So we're just going to pause for a minute. I want to share some information with you. Number one, if you are a brand new listener to the show, we welcome you and also want you to know the programming is done Monday through Friday from 8 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time. And we have another program called Warriors for Peace that is done every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. And you can keep in touch with us via going to the network page. All you have to do is Google my name, Donna Sebo, S-E-E-B-O, and you'll find that there will be a connection you can make directly to the network page, and you'll also have access to the calendar itself. So that gives you who's coming up on the program. Also, we have an email newsletter that if you wanted to subscribe to that, you will get the monthly report of who's coming up on the show, my public appearances as well. Don't forget, we have the Donna Sebo television show, special editions. All of the programs are posted up on YouTube as well as on my website. And we're in the process of doing filming this month and next month. And as soon as all of that is completed, we will let you know about it. Now, if you're an author, if you have anything from a cookbook to sci-fi, whatever it might be, the show is very eclectic. And if you would like to send me a copy of your publication, then all you need to do is to go to my website, DelphiInternational.com, send me an email, and let me know your contact information. But be sure you send me a copy of your publication, and that is to the Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington, 98496. Again, that's the Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington, 98496. And my goodness, we've got so much that we want to share with you. Oh, I almost forgot. I am going to be speaking at an IHOP restaurant with a group called It's Happening. Sandy McNaughton is the person that is in charge of this gathering, which is held the first and third Thursday of every month. This is the IHOP restaurant in Federal Way, Washington, on Campus Drive. And you can go into my website, DelphiInternational.com, and you'll find out all the details there. So as we move along, and I've got more good things to share with you, and, well, it's a little bit of this and a little bit of that. So this is what's going to be going on for the rest of the program. Have you ever considered making a friend of yourself? Now, someone, when you would ask that question, might say, gee, isn't that being a little narcissistic? No, we're not talking about looking at a mirror and just being absolutely, totally obsessed with who you are and that you're the most magnificent human being on this planet. No, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about really being able to enjoy your own company. And, you know, it's fascinating how difficult that can be. And it's an awareness of yourself, whether you have friends around you, family around you, or you're by yourself, you're going to be content. You're going to find that you can enjoy your own company. That's a tough one. And there was a friend of mine that I was visiting, and we were talking about members of the family passing away, et cetera, and the effect it has on people. And this person said to me, I have never been alone in my life. And she was finding that this is what was evolving and totally unaccustomed to that. And I said, you know, it's very interesting that you say that because I'm just the opposite. During my childhood and through much of my adult life, being alone was something that I experienced, and I'm totally comfortable with it. It's not something that I consider a negative. And I find it so fascinating that it really takes a long time to learn how to be comfortable in your own space and being aware of yourself and be willing to invest in yourself, but having that trust of the self. And Eckhart Tolle, who's known around the globe, he said, when you make friends with the present moment, you feel at home no matter where you are. And I had a conversation with a friend of mine who is going between countries at this time. And I said, gee whiz, you've got your family here, and I'm sure that that makes it very difficult. How is it you're able to adapt? She said, wherever I am, I'm happy. She said, if I'm in another country and I'm there for a few months, I'm happy. If I'm here in my home in the United States, I'm happy. She said, I've just learned to be happy wherever I am. So I just thought I would share that thought with you. And I will repeat Eckhart Tolle's thought. When you make friends with the present moment, you feel at home, no matter where you are. And I thought those words were especially poignant. Well, there's a number of things that I wanted to share with you. And one of those items that I wanted to share was something that occurred in a woman's life that she never expected. And the other person that this serendipitous situation, some might call it a coincidence, but I call it just totally magical. The woman's name is Lenore, and she was going through a real tough time in her life. It was 2022, you know about the lockdown. Well, at that time, she was being treated for breast cancer. She was working 12 to 15 hours a day. She had a bakery. She was self-employed, an entrepreneur. She had been running the business for 14 years. Her daughter, who was, you know, would have been a great help to her if she had been there, but she was on the other side of the world. She was a teacher in Beijing, China. And she was just highly, highly stressed. She thought she was going to lose the shop. Well, there's a gentleman by the name of Vamar, and he said, he had been a regular at Give Me Some Sugar, and sugar is spelled S-U-G-A-H, for about 10 years. That was the name of Lenore's shop. And this is in Chicago. And he said he just loved the bakery. It felt like home to him. He was, at one time, he said, engaged. And he said, Miss Lenore, he always called her Miss Lenore, took a liking to the woman that he was engaged to at the time, whose name was Megan. Well, Lenore was a little perplexed because Vamar would always be at her bakery. And she said, I really liked Megan, his fiancée, but I wondered often to myself, why is he hanging around my bakery so much? Well, Vamar had a good job. He had worked it as a logistics and supply chain manager. But he was just moving along. He said, trying to keep things stable. At 17 years of age, he became a father. Yes, he's one of those young people that ended up having a lot of babies in his life. And he ended up having three more kids after that. And that included one of the women that he had known, Megan. And Megan had had one of his children, a 7-year-old son, at the time that this was happening in 2022. And he's very close to his own family. Well, Lenore said she had become a parent herself at the age of 17, but she ended up giving up the baby for adoption. Now, Vimar is in the bakery so frequently, they develop a very good friendship. But he said he had never, even though he had been adopted, he had never looked for his biological mother. He said, I was afraid she was going to be like my adopted mother, who just was not a very nice person. So at the age of 47, he decided he was going to see if he could find out about his biological mother. So he ended up hiring someone to try to find her. And Lenore one day gets a call from an investigator telling me that her son was looking for her. Now, she absolutely was stunned when this was stated to her. And the investigator was a woman and gave Lenore the phone number. And she said, you know what? I was really scared because I had no idea what kind of drama it was going to bring. And she said, for all I knew, the child could have ended up being in drugs or whatever. She said, I was having such a time with my life just trying to keep my bakery going that I just thought, well, you know, whatever. I'm just going to go and check this out. And she knew, because the investigator told her, that her biological son wanted to talk to her. So she had planned on just saying, you know, I cannot deal with this right now, just in case things didn't work out. So she ends up calling him. Vimar says his phone rings, and the caller ID read, give me some sugar. And he thought to himself, he said, I didn't order anything. Well, Lenore, when he answered the phone, started talking, and he interrupted her. He said, Miss Lenore, it's Vimar. You know, Vimar and Megan, they come into the bakery all the time. And so she thought, oh, the boyfriend. And then it dawned on him. The investigation that was done by the female investigator had linked together Lamar with his biological mother, who was Lenore. They had been absolutely interacting for 10 years without knowing that they belonged together as family. And Mamar said, you know, I was apprehensive because I didn't know what I was going to get. But Lenore, he said, I already knew her for a long time. I really liked her and respect her. Well, Lenore, you can imagine they had quite a conversation. She found out that the mother that had adopted him was just not, well, a woman that really should have adopted. And she was very sad over that. But she said, you know what? Vimar and I are so much alike. She said, I was absolutely stunned. I needed help. And he started helping her at the bakery shop. She said, this is a son who I never did anything for because I was too young at 17 to be a mother and allowed him to be put out for adoption. She said, he didn't owe me a thing. And yet he said, I'm going to help you. She said, it was amazing. I could take a breath because he was there. She said, I was able to keep the bakery open and complete my cancer treatment. She said, now I'm cancer-free. Vimar, in the interview that was going on, he said, for 2 years, I went to the bakery most days after work so I could learn how to bake. He said, now that I know she's my real mom, I've learned how to cook and bake. And he said, she says my cakes are better than hers. He said, when a local newspaper got a hold of our story, he said it went viral. Lenore said, before this happened, I felt like I was approaching the end of the business, the end of my life. But when I heard his voice on the phone, she said, something jumped in my spirit. I've got to keep my eyes and heart open because there's another chapter coming. She thought to herself before she knew that Vamar was her son. You know, life has a way of bringing circumstances and stories into place. And I just am intrigued with the whole thing. Those coincidences, those synchronistic moments. What are the odds that an adopted child is visiting the very, very place where his real mother is running a business and doing it for over 10 years? They didn't know anything about the biological relationship. How could they? Fascinating stuff. Life has so many miracles in it. I love those kinds of stories because it always makes us aware that there's a lot of mystery in life, and more than that, you just never know how things are going to turn out. It's just having that little bit of faith, like the grain of a mustard seed, that old saying. It pays off. You never know, though, how it's going to pay off. Well, as always, I like to talk about recipes. But these recipes came from one of my guests, Anne Chardonnay. Now, this is a woman that lived for a number of years up in Alaska. And for those of you that love fish, you know, there's just so many species of fish. I am not a big fish person. I never have been. When I was growing up, it was Italian meals. I don't remember any fish meals to speak of, unless it was a can of tuna fish that you mixed with mayonnaise and pickle relish and whatever else you could come up with. And you know, the tuna really seemed to taste a lot different than it does today. But anyway, fish was just, other than tuna fish, it just wasn't in the house. Although my dad might fix trout every once in a while. But even so, he didn't do a lot of fishing. That wasn't his thing. So that wasn't a part of my life. However, up in Alaska, oh boy, people love their fish. Have you ever heard of the hooligan? That's an actual fish. H-O-O-L-I-G-A-N. Well, this is something with this fish. And when it comes through in Alaska, it's really significant. Do you know, and I didn't know this until Anne educated me on it, that a fish could be a candle? I'm not making this up. The hooligan, its name, alternate name, is the candlefish, are so oily, they actually, you can light it, and it'll give you light. Now, the Tinglek people would dry them, insert a wick of twisted spruce bark and viola, the fish became a candle. And they are known also as a Columbia River smelt. But they are related to the Atlantic smelt and the grunion. And they are very pretty fish, apparently. They shimmer, and they are the color of brown to dark blue, and they have black flecks on their back and a silver belly. And it's said that the hooligans are spring crocus. It's equivalent to the Capistrano swallow of Alaska fish. It's the very first to run up the rivers after the winter's ice breaks up. I have never, ever heard of the hooligan, as many times as I've been to Alaska. But it is that short season. And they come out in anywhere from late February or early March, and also in the Cook Inlet near Anchorage in May, before the other fish start coming through. Yes, they have their hierarchy. And this is one of them. And the indigenous people really depended on these fish because it often saved them from starving after a harsh winter. And they would be all summer long putting together their stores of food But, hey, sometimes as much as you plan or as much as you save, depending on how many people are assisting with that process, you may still run out, depending on what the circumstances are during the winter and how long the winter would last. And they would render the oil they'd get from the hooligan fish in baskets, and they just did all kinds of things with this fish. And the hooligan oil, the Alaskans considered very, very necessary, the natives, to their diet. And they say it's a little friend to all of the world. And, of course, during the winter months with the bitter cold temperatures, the fat was used to be a complement to the diet because it helped you to stay warm. And the oil would help reconstitute dried staples, where it contributed iodine and oil-soluble vitamins as well. So there is a restaurant up in Alaska. Actually, it's not just a restaurant, but it is a sports fisherman. Calvin Donnelly of Hope, Alaska, gave a recipe to Anne. And this is what it is. It's real simple, and it also has what's called a caper sauce. And this is what you need. 2 pounds of hooligan, gutted and heads removed, 1/3 cup of whole milk, 1/3 cup of flour, 1/3 cup of yellow cornmeal, 2 teaspoons of salt, a little bit of freshly ground black pepper, and you're going to need some oil for frying. Now, your caper sauce, you're going to need 1/4 cup of butter, the juice of 1/2 lemon, 1 tablespoon of drained capers, and 1 tablespoon of minced fresh parsley. Your butter to make the caper sauce, you melt that in a saucepan, add the lemon juice, capers, and parsley. Bingo, you got your sauce done. Now, your fish, you want to gut them and remove the heads. You want to dry them with paper towels. Pour the milk into a soup plate, and on another plate, have your flour, cornmeal, salt, and pepper mill mixed together. And you dip the fish into the milk, roll it into the flour mixture, heat enough of the oil or shortening to cover the bottom of a skillet, and pan fry the fish for about 5 minutes on each side until it's well browned and cooked through. And then when you're getting ready to put it on the platter or on a plate, you pour the caper sauce over the hot fish and pass it along. Or you can pass it along in a gravy boat, but just put it right on top of the fish. It's wonderful. But I wanted to share that with you because there are so many things that we can learn. And again, I've never heard of hooligan fish. Never. But Anne educated me, and it really is significant because it does make a difference. In our so-called civilized world, when it comes to food, so often we forget how other people might have survived during their times and whatever environments they lived in. But I always find it very, very intriguing when I meet up with someone that's a native and they say that the Alaskan diet keeps them healthier than if they eat the white man's food. And by golly, they're right. Because their bodies, their physiological chemistry over the centuries, and they've lived up in Alaska and in the far north for thousands and thousands of years, and their physiology adapted. And to this day, it often baffles scientists that their physiology is so unique, they don't have heart disease. They don't until they start following what you'd call the white man's diet. They just don't have it for all of the fat they eat and everything else. And they're not a fat people. Their bodies are very efficient. And actually, what they were eating when they really did some homework on it was pretty healthy for them. Now, for a lot of us, having whale blubber, that may not be something that we want to have on our dinner plate, but hey, we're not living up in the far north either. Donna Sebo here. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul, no matter where you are, no matter who you are. I hope you will join me tomorrow evening, and we are going to be talking about Kama Sutra for senior citizens. Won't you join us? Take care now. Talk to you then. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.